no longer mattered whether his bodyguards could overpower the Jedi or not. They would all burn together. He tapped his jaw sensor to the control frequency for the escape pods. One coded order ensured that his personal pod would be waiting for him, with engines hot and systems checks complete. When he looked back to the fight, all he could see of IG-102 was one arm, the saber-cut joint still white-hot. Skywalker was pursuing two super battle droids that had Palpatine by the arms. While Skywalker dismantled the droids with swift cuts, Kenobi was in the process of doing the same to IG-101. The Magna Guard was hopping on its one remaining leg, whirling its electro staff with one remaining arm, and screeching some improbable threat regarding its staff and Kenobi's body cavities. And after Kenobi cut off the arm, 101 went hopping after him, still screeching. The droid actually managed to land one glancing kick before the Jedi casually severed its other leg, after which 101's limbless torso continued to ride on the deck, howling. With both Magna Guards down, all eight destroyers opened up, dual cannons erupting gouts of galvaned particle beams. The two Jedi leapt together to screen the Chancellor, and before Grievous could command the destroyers to cease fire, the Jedi had deflected enough of the bolts to blow apart three-quarters of the remaining super battle droids and send the survivors scurrying for cover beside what was left of the cringing Nymoidians. The destroyers began to close in, hosing down the Jedi with heavy fire, advancing step by step, cannons against lightsabers. The Jedi caught every blast and sent them back against the destroyer's shields that flared in spherical halos as they absorbed the reflected bolts. The destroyers might very well have prevailed over the Jedi, except for one unexpected difficulty. Gravity shear. All eight of them suddenly seemed inexplicably to leap into the air, followed by Skywalker and Palpatine, and chairs and pieces of Magna Guards and everything else on the bridge that was not bolted to the deck, except for Kenobi, who managed to grab a control console and now was hanging by one hand upside down, still effortlessly deflecting blaster bolts. The surviving Nymoidian pilot was screaming orders for the droids to magnetize, then started howling that the ship was breaking up, and managed to make so much annoying noise that Grievous smashed his skull out of simple irritation. Then he looked around and realized he'd just killed the last of his crew. All the bridge crew he hadn't slain personally had sucked up the bulk of the random blaster ricochets. Grievous shook the pilot's brains off his fist. Disgusting creatures, Nymoidians. The invisible plane of altered gravity passed over the biodroid general without effect. His talons of magnetized uranium kept him right where he was, and as one of the Magna Guard's electrostaffs fell past him, his invisibly fast hand snatched it from the air. When another plane of gravity shear swept through the bridge, droids, Chancellor, and Jedi all fell back to the floor. Though the Droidica, also known as the Destroyer Droid, was the most powerful infantry combat droid in general production, it had one major design flaw. The energy shield that was so effective in stopping blasters, slugs, shrapnel, and even lightsabers was precisely tuned to englobe the droid in a standing position. If the droid was no longer standing, say if it was knocked down or thrown into a wall, the shield generator could not distinguish a floor or a wall from a weapon, and would keep ramping up power to disintegrate this perceived threat until the generator shorted itself out. Between falling to the ceiling, bouncing off it, and falling back to the floor, the sum total output of all the shield generators of Squad 8 was currently one large cloud of black smoke. It was impossible to say which one of them opened fire on the Jedi, and it didn't matter. Inside of 2 seconds, eight droidicas had become eight piles of smoking scrap, and two Jedi, entirely unscathed, walked out of the smoke, side by side. Without a word, they parted to bracket the general. Grievous clicked the electrostaff's power setting to overload. It spat lightning around him as he lifted it to combat ready.
I am sorry I don't have time to fight you. It would have been an interesting match. But I have an appointment with an escape pod. And you...
He pointed at the transparasteel view wall and triggered his own concealed cable gun, not unlike the one that fancy astromech of theirs had. The cable shot out and its grappling claw buried itself in one of the panel supports.
You have appointments with death.
The Jedi leapt, and Grievous hurled the overloading electro staff, but not at the Jedi. He threw it at a window. One of the transparasteel panels of the view wall had cracked under a glancing hit from a starfighter's cannon. When the sparking electro staff hit it squarely and exploded like a proton grenade, the whole panel blew out into space. A hurricane roared to life, raging through the bridge, seizing Nymordian corpses and pieces of droids and wreckage and hurling them out through the gap, along with a white fountain of flash-frozen air. Grievous sprang straight up into the instant hurricane, narrowly avoiding the two Jedi, whose leaps had become frantic tumbles as they tried to avoid being sucked through along with him. Grievous, though, had no need to breathe, nor had he any fear of his body fluids boiling in the vacuum. The pressurized synth flesh that enclosed the living parts within his droid exoskeleton saw to that. So he simply rode the storm right out into space, until he reached the end of the cable, and it snapped tight, and swung him whipping back toward Invisible Hand's hull. He cast off the cable. His hands and feet of magnetized uranium let him scramble along the hull without difficulty, the light-spidered curve of Coruscant's nightside whirling around him. He clambered over to the external locks of the bridge escape pods and punched in a command code. Looking back over his shoulder, he experienced a certain chilly satisfaction as he watched empty escape pods blast free of the Hand's bridge and streak away. All of them. Well, all but one. No trick of the Force would spring Kenobi and Skywalker out of this one. It was a shame he didn't have a spy probe handy to leave on the bridge. He would have enjoyed watching the Republic's greatest heroes burn. The ion streaks of the escape pods spiraled through the battle that still flashed and flared silently in the void, pursued by starfighters and armed retrieval ships. Grievous nodded to himself. That should occupy them long enough for his command pod to make the run to his escape ship. As he entered his customized pod, he reflected that he was, for the first time in his career, violating orders. Though he was under strict orders to leave the Chancellor unharmed, Palpatine was about to die alongside his precious Jedi. Then Grievous shrugged and sighed. What more could he have done? There was a war on, after all. He was sure Lord Sidious would forgive him. On the bridge, a blast shield had closed over the destroyed transparasteel window, and every last surviving combat model droid had been cut to pieces even before the atmosphere had had a chance to stabilize. But there was a more serious problem. The bucking of the ship had become continuous. White-hot sparks outside streamed backward past the view wall windows. Those sparks, according to the three different kinds of alarms that were all screaming through the bridge at once, were what was left of the ablative shielding on the nose of the disabled cruiser. Anakin stared grimly down at a console readout. All the escape pods are gone. Not one left in the whole ship. He looked up at Obi-Wan. We're trapped. Obi-Wan appeared more interested than actually concerned. Well, here's the chance to display your legendary piloting skills, my young friend. You can fly this cruiser, can't you? Flying's no problem. The trick is landing, which, Anakin gave a slightly shaky laugh. Which, you know, this cruiser is not exactly designed to do, even when it's in one piece. Obi-Wan looked unimpressed. And so? Anakin unsnapped the crash webbing that held the pilot's corpse and pulled the body from its chair. And so, you'd better strap in, he said, settling into the chair, his fingers sliding over the unfamiliar controls. The cruiser bounced even harder, and its attitude began to skew as a new klaxon joined the blare of the other alarms. That wasn't me! Anakin jerked his hands away from the board. I haven't even done anything yet. It certainly wasn't. Palpatine's voice was unnaturally calm. It seems someone is shooting at us. Wonderful. Anakin muttered. Could this day get any better? Perhaps we can talk with them. Obi-Wan moved over to the comm station and began working the screen. Let them know we've captured the ship. All right, take the comm, Anakin said. He pointed at the co-pilot station. R2, second chair. Chancellor?
Yes?
Strap in. Now. We're going in hot. Anakin grimaced at the scraps of burning hull flashing past the view wall. In more ways than one. The vast space battle that had ripped and battered Coruscant space all this long, long day finally began to flicker out. The shimmering canopy of ion trails and turbo laser bursts was fading into streaks of ships achieving jump as the Separatist strike force fled in full retreat. The light of Coruscant's distant star splintered through iridescent clouds of gas crystals that were the remains of starfighters and of pilots. Damaged cruisers limped toward space yards, passing shattered hulks that hung dead in the infinite day that is interplanetary space. Prize crews took command of surrendered ships, imprisoning the living among their crews and affixing restraining bolts to the droids. The dayside surface of the capital planet was shrouded in smoke from a million fires, touched off by meteorite impacts of ship fragments. Far too many had fallen to be tracked and destroyed by the planet's surface defense umbrella. The nightside sheet of artificial lights faded behind the red-white glow from craters of burning steel. Each impact left a caldera of unimaginable death. In the skies of Coruscant now, the important vessels were no longer warships, but were instead the fire suppression and rescue craft that crisscrossed the planet. Now, one last fragmentary ship screamed into the atmosphere, coming in too fast, too steep, pieces breaking off to spread apart and stream their own contrails of superheated vapor. Banks of turbolasers on the surface defense towers isolated their signature, and starfighters whipped onto interception courses to thin out whatever fragments the SD towers might miss. And far above, beyond the atmosphere, on the bridge of RSS Integrity, Lieutenant Commander Lorth Nida spoke urgently to a knee-high blue ghost scanned into existence by the phased array lasers in a holocom. An alien in Jedi robes, with bulging eyes set in a wrinkled face and long, pointed, oddly flexible ears.
You have to stand down the surface defense system, sir. It's General Kenobi, Nida insisted. His code verifies. Skywalker is with them, and they have Chancellor Palpatine.
Heard and understood this is,
the Jedi responded calmly.
Tell me what they require.
Nida glanced down at the boil of hull plating that was burning off the fallen cruiser, and even as he looked, the ship broke in half at the hangar deck. The rear half tumbled, exploding in sections. But whoever was flying the front half must have been one of the greatest pilots Nida had ever even heard of. The front half wobbled and slewed, but somehow righted itself, using nothing but a bank of thrusters and its atmospheric drag fins.
First, a flight of fire ships, Nida said more calmly now. If they don't get the burn-off under control, there won't be enough hull left to make the surface. And a hardened docking platform, the strongest available. They won't be able to set it down. This won't be a landing. It will be a controlled crash. Repeat, a controlled crash.
Heard and understood this is,
the hologramic Jedi repeated.
Cross-load their transponder signature.
When this was done, the Jedi nodded grave approval.
Thank you, Lieutenant Commander. Valiant service for the Republic you have done today, and the gratitude of the Jedi Order you have earned. Yoda out.
On the Bridge of Integrity, Lorth Nida now could only stand and watch, hands clasped behind his back. Military discipline kept him expressionless, but pale bands began at his knuckles and spread whiteness nearly to his wrists. Every bone in his body ached with helplessness, because he knew that fragment of a ship was a death trap. No one could land such a hulk, not even Skywalker. Each second that passed before its final breakup and burn was a miracle in itself, a testament to the gifts of a pilot who was justly legendary. But when each second is a miracle,
How many of them can be strung together in a row? Lorth Nida was not religious, nor was he a philosopher or metaphysician. He knew of the Force only by reputation, but nonetheless, now he found himself asking the Force in his heart that when the fiery end came for the men in that scrap of a ship, it might at least come quickly. His eyes stung. The irony of it burned the back of his throat. The home fleet had fought brilliantly, and the Jedi had done their superhuman part against all odds. The Republic had won the day. Yet this battle had been fought to save Supreme Chancellor Palpatine. They had won the battle. But now, as Nida stood watching helplessly, he couldn't help feeling that they were about to lose the war. This is Anakin Skywalker's masterpiece. Many people say he is the best star pilot in the galaxy, but that's merely talk. Born of the constant HoloNet references to his unmatched string of kills in starfighter combat. Blowing up vulture droids and tri-fighters is simply a matter of superior reflexes and trust in the Force. He has spent so many hours in the cockpit that he wears a Jedi starfighter-like clothes. It's his own body, with thrusters for legs and cannons for fists. What he is doing right now transcends mere flying the way Jedi combat transcends a schoolyard scuffle. He sits in a blood-spattered, blaster-chopped chair behind a console he's never seen before. A console with controls designed for alien fingers. The ship he's in is not only bucking like a maddened dewback through brutal coils of clear air turbulence, it's on fire and breaking up like a comet ripping apart as it crashes into a gas giant. He has only seconds to learn how to maneuver an alien craft that not only has no aft control cells, but has no aft at all. This is, put simply, impossible. It can't be done. He's going to do it anyway, because he is Anakin Skywalker, and he doesn't believe in impossible. He extends his hands, and for one long, long moment, he merely strokes controls, feeling their shape under his fingers, listening to the shivers his soft touch brings to each remaining control surface of the disintegrating ship, allowing the resonances to join inside his head until they resolve into harmony, like a Faroan joy harp virtuoso, checking the tuning of his instrument. And at the same time, he draws power from the Force. He gathers perception and luck, and sucks into himself the instinctive preconscious what-will-happen-in-the-next-10-seconds intuition that has always been the core of his talent. And then he begins. On the downbeat, atmospheric drag fins deploy. As he tweaks their angles and cycles them in and out to slow the ship's descent without burning them off altogether, their contrabass roar takes on a punctuated rhythm like a heart that skips an occasional beat. The forward attitude thrusters, damaged in the ship-to-ship battle, now fire in random directions, but he can feel where they're taking him, and he strokes them in sequence, making their song the theme of his impromptu concerto. And the true inspiration, the sparkling grace note of genius that brings his masterpiece to life, is the soprano counterpoint, a syncopated sequence of exterior hatches in the outer hull, sliding open and closed and open again, subtly altering the aerodynamics of the ship to give it just exactly the amount of side slip or lift or yaw to bring the huge half-cruiser into the approach cone of a pinpoint target an eighth of the planet away. It is the Force that makes this possible, and more than the Force. Anakin has no interest in serene acceptance of what the Force will bring. Not here. Not now. Not with the lives of Palpatine and Obi-Wan at stake. It's just the opposite. He seizes upon the Force with a stark refusal to fail. He will land this ship. He will save his friends. Between his will and the will of the Force, there is no contest. Part 2. Seduction. The dark is generous, and it is patient. It is the dark that seeds cruelty into justice, that drips contempt into compassion, that poisons love with grains of doubt. The dark can be patient, because the slightest drop of rain will cause those seeds to sprout. The rain will come, and the seeds will sprout, for the dark is the soil in which they grow, and it is the clouds above them, and it waits behind the star that gives them light. The dark's patience is infinite. Eventually, even stars burn out. Chapter 8. Fault Lines. Mace Windu hung on to the corrugated hatch grip beside the gunship's open troop bay with one hand, squinting into the wind that whipped his overcloak behind him. His other hand shaded his eyes against the glare from one of the orbital mirrors that concentrated the capital planet's daylight. The mirror was slowly turning aside now, allowing a band of twilight to approach the gunship's destination. That destination, a kilometer-thick landing platform in the planet's vast industrial zone, was marked with a steeply slanting tower of smoke and vapor that stretched from the planet's surface to the uppermost reaches of the atmosphere. A tower that only now was beginning to spread and coil from its tiny source point to a horizon-spanning smear across the stratospheric winds. The gunship roared over the bottomless canyons of durasteel and permacrete that formed the landscape of Coruscant, arrowing straight for the industrial zone without regard for the rigid traffic laws that governed flight on the galactic planet. Until martial law was officially lifted by the Senate, the darkening skies would be traveled only by Republic military craft, Jedi transports, and emergency vehicles. The gunship qualified as all three. Mace could see the ship now, what was left of it, resting on the scorched platform far ahead. A piece of a ship, a fragment, less than a third of what once had been the Trade Federation flagship, still burning, despite the gouts of fire suppression foam raining down on it from five different ships and the emergency support clone troops who surrounded it on the platform. Mace shook his head. Skywalker again. The Chosen One. Who else could have brought in this hulk? Who else could have even come close? The gunship swung into a hot landing, repulsors howling. Mace hopped out before it could settle and gave the pilot an open palm gesture to signal him to wait. The pilot, faceless within his helmet, responded with a closed fist. Though, of course, the pilot wasn't faceless at all. Under his armored helmet, that clone pilot had a face that Mace Windu remembered all too well. That face would always remind him that he had once held Dooku within his grasp and had let him slip away. Across the platform, an escape pod hatch cycled open. Emergency crews scrambled with an escape slide, and a moment later, the Supreme Chancellor, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and Anakin Skywalker were all on the deck beside the burning ship, closely followed by a somewhat battered R2 unit that lifted itself down on customized maneuvering rockets. Mace strode swiftly out to meet them. Palpatine's robes were scorched and tattered at the hem, and he seemed weak. He leaned a bit on Skywalker's shoulder as they moved away from the ship. On Skywalker's other side, Master Kenobi seemed to touch the worse for wear himself, caked with dust and leaking a trickle of blood from a scalp wound. Skywalker, by contrast, looked every bit the Holonet hero he was supposed to be. He seemed to tower over his companions, as though he had somehow gotten even taller in the months since Mace had seen him last. His hair was tousled. His color was high, and his walk still had the grounded grace of a natural fighter. But there was something new in his physicality, in the way he moved his head, perhaps, or the way the weight of Palpatine's arm on his shoulder seemed somehow to belong there, or something less definable, some new ease, new confidence, an aura of inner power, presence. Skywalker was not the same young man the Council had sent off to the Outer Rim 5 standard months ago.
Chancellor, Mace said as he met them, are you well? Do you need medical attention?
He gestured over his shoulder at the waiting gunship.
I have a fully equipped field surgery.
No need, Palpatine said rather faintly.
Thank you, Master Windu, but I am well. Quite well, thanks to these two.
Mace nodded. Master Kenobi? Anakin?
Never better, Skywalker replied, looking as if he meant it.
And Kenobi only shrugged with a slight wince as he touched his scalp wound.
Only a bump on the head. That field surgery must be needed elsewhere.
It is. Mace looked grim. We don't even have a preliminary estimate of civilian casualties.
He waved off the gunship and it roared away toward the countless fires that painted red the approach of night.
A shuttle is on its way. Chancellor, we'll have you on the Senate floor within the hour. The HoloNet has already been notified that you will want to make a statement.
I will. I will indeed. Palpatine touched Mace on the arm.
You have always been of great value to me, Master Windu.
Thank you.
The Jedi are honored to serve the Senate, sir.
There might have been the slightest emphasis on the word Senate. Mace remained expressionless as he subtly moved his arm away from the Chancellor's hand. He looked at Obi-Wan.
Is there anything else to report, Master Kenobi? What of General Grievous?
Count Dooku was there, Skywalker interjected. He had a look on his face that Mace couldn't decipher, proud yet wary, even unhappy. He's dead now.
Dead?
He looked from Anakin to Obi-Wan and back again.
Is this true? You killed Count Dooku?
My young friend is too modest. He killed Count Dooku. Smiling, Kenobi touched the lump on his head. I was taking a nap.
But...
Mace blinked. Dooku was to the Separatists what Palpatine was to the Republic. The center of gravity binding together a spiral galaxy of special interests. With Dooku gone, the Confederacy of Independent Systems would no longer really be a confederacy at all. They'd fly to pieces within weeks. Within days.
Mace said again, but...
And in the end, he couldn't think of a but.
This was all so astonishing that he very nearly, almost but not quite, cracked a smile. That is, he said, the best news I've heard since...
He shook his head.
Since I can't remember. Anakin, how did you do it?
Inexplicably, young Skywalker looked distinctly uncomfortable. That newly confident presence of his collapsed as suddenly as an overloaded deflector. And instead of meeting Mace's eyes, his gaze flicked to Palpatine. Somehow Mace didn't think this was modesty. He looked to the Chancellor as well, his elation sinking, becoming puzzlement, tinged with suspicion. It was entirely extraordinary, Palpatine said blandly, oblivious to Mace's narrowing stare. I know next to nothing of swordplay, of course. To my amateur's eye, it seemed that Count Dooku may have been a trace overconfident, especially after having disposed of Master Kenobi so neatly. Obi-Wan flushed just a bit, and Anakin flushed considerably more deeply. Perhaps young Anakin was simply more highly motivated, Palpatine said, turning a fond smile upon him. After all, Dooku was fighting only to slay an enemy. Anakin was fighting to save, if I may presume the honor, a friend.
Mace's scowl darkened. Fine words. Perhaps even true words, but he still didn't like them.
No one on the Jedi Council had ever been comfortable with Skywalker's close relationship with the Chancellor. They'd had more than one conversation about it with Obi-Wan while Skywalker had still been his Padawan, and Mace was less than happy to hear Palpatine speaking for a young Jedi who seemed unprepared to speak for himself.
He said, I'm sure the Council will be very interested in your full report, Anakin,
with just enough emphasis on full to get his point across. Skywalker swallowed, and then, just as suddenly as it had collapsed, that aura of calm, centered confidence rebuilt itself around him.
Yes. Yes, of course, Master Windu.
And we must report that Grievous escaped, Obi-Wan said. He is as cowardly as ever.
Mace accepted this news with a nod. But he is only a military commander. Without Dooku to hold the coalition together, these so-called independent systems will splinter, and they know it.
He looks straight into the Supreme Chancellor's eyes.
This is our best chance to sue for peace. We can end this war right now.
And while Palpatine answered, Mace Windu reached into the Force. To Mace's Force perception, the world crystallized around them, becoming a gem of reality shot through with flaws and fault lines of possibility. This was Mace's particular gift, to see how people and situations fit together in the Force, to find the sheer planes that can cause them to break in useful ways, and to intuit what sort of strike would best make the cut. Though he could not consistently determine the significance of the structures he perceived, the darkening cloud upon the Force that had risen with the rebirth of the Sith made that harder and harder with each passing day. The presence of shatter points was always clear. Mace had supported the training of Anakin Skywalker, though it ran counter to millennia of Jedi tradition, because from the structure of fault lines in the Force around him, he had been able to intuit the truth of Qui-Gon Jinn's guess, that the young slave boy from Tatooine was in fact the prophesied chosen one, born to bring balance to the Force. He had argued for the elevation of Obi-Wan Kenobi to mastership, and to give the training of the Chosen One into the hands of this new, untested master, because his unique perception had shown him powerful lines of destiny that bound their lives together, for good or ill. On the day of Palpatine's election to the Chancellorship, he had seen that Palpatine was himself a shatterpoint of unimaginable significance, a man upon whom might depend the fate of the Republic itself. Now he saw the three men together, and the intricate lattice of fault lines and stress fractures that bound them each to the other was so staggeringly powerful that its structure was beyond calculation. Anakin was somehow a pivot point, the fulcrum of a lever, with Obi-Wan on one side, Palpatine on the other, and the galaxy in the balance. But the dark cloud on the Force prevented his perception from reaching into the future for so much as a hint of where this might lead. The balance was already so delicate that he could not guess the outcome of any given shift. The slightest tip in any direction would generate chaotic oscillation. Anything could happen. Anything at all. And the lattice of fault lines that bound all three of them to each other stank of the dark side. He lifted his head and looked to the sky, picking out the dropping star of the Jedi shuttle as it swung toward them through the darkening afternoon.
"I'm afraid peace is out of the question while Grievous is at large," the Chancellor was saying sadly. "Dooku was the only check on Grievous's monstrous lust for slaughter. With Dooku gone, the General has been unleashed to rampage across the galaxy. I'm afraid that, far from being over, this war is about to get a very great deal worse."
"And what of the Sith?" Obi-Wan said. "Dooku's death should have at least begun the weakening of the darkness, but instead it feels stronger than ever."
"I fear Master Yoda's intuition is correct, that Dooku was merely the apprentice to the Sith Lord, not the Master."
Mace started walking toward the small craft dock where the Jedi shuttle would land, and the others fell in with him.
"The Sith Lord, if one still exists, will reveal himself in time. They always do."
He hoped Obi-Wan would take the hint and shut up about it. Mace had no desire to speak openly of the investigation in front of the Supreme Chancellor. The less Palpatine knew, the better.
"A more interesting puzzle is Grievous," he said. "He had you at his mercy, Chancellor, and mercy is not numbered among his virtues. Though we all rejoice that he spared you, I cannot help but wonder why."
Palpatine spread his hands.
"I can only assume the Separatists preferred to have me as a hostage rather than as a martyr. Though it is, of course, impossible to say. It may merely have been a whim of the General. He is notoriously erratic."
"Perhaps the Separatist leadership can restrain him in exchange for certain..."
Mace let his gaze drift casually to a point somewhere above the Chancellor's head.
"Considerations."
"Absolutely not."
Palpatine drew himself up, straightening his robes.
A negotiated peace would be a recognition of the CIS as the legitimate government of the rebellious systems, tantamount to losing the war. No, Master Windu. This war can end only one way. Unconditional surrender. And while Grievous lives, that will never happen.
Very well, May said. Then the Jedi will make the capture of General Grievous our particular task.
He glanced at Anakin and Obi-Wan, then back to Palpatine. He leaned close to the Chancellor, and his voice went low and final, with a buried intensity that hinted just the slightest bit of suspicion and warning.
This war has gone on far too long already. We will find him, and this war will end.
I have no doubt of it. Palpatine strolled along, seemingly oblivious.
But we should never underestimate the deviousness of the Separatists. It is possible that even the war itself has been only one further move, he said with elegant, understated precision, in some greater game.
As the Jedi shuttle swung toward the Chancellor's private landing platform at the Senate offices, Obi-Wan watched Anakin pretending not to stare out the window. On the platform was a small welcome contingent of senators, and Anakin was trying desperately to look as if he wasn't searching that little crowd hungrily for a particular face. The pretense was a waste of time. Anakin radiated excitement so powerfully in the Force that Obi-Wan could practically hear the thunder of his heartbeat. Obi-Wan gave a silent sigh. He had entirely too good an idea whose face his former Padawan was so hoping to see. When the shuttle touched down, Master Windu caught his eye from beyond Anakin's shoulder. The Corrin Master made a nearly invisible gesture, to which Obi-Wan did not visibly respond. But when Palpatine and Anakin and R2 all debarked toward the crowd of well-wishers, Obi-Wan stayed behind. Anakin stopped on the landing deck, looking back at Obi-Wan. You coming?
I haven't the courage for politics, Obi-Wan said, showing his usual trace of a smile.
I'll brief the council.
Shouldn't I be there too?
No need. This isn't the formal report. Besides, Obi-Wan nodded toward the clot of holonet crews clogging the pedestrian gangway. Someone has to be the poster boy. Anakin looked pained.
Poster man.
Quite right. Quite right. Obi-Wan said with a gentle chuckle.
Go meet your public, poster man.
Wait a minute. This whole operation was your idea. You planned it. You led the rescue. It's your turn to take the bows.
You won't get out of it that easily, my young friend. Without you, I wouldn't even have made it to the flagship. You killed Count Dooku and single-handedly rescued the Chancellor. All while, I might be forgiven for adding, carrying some old broken-down Jedi Master unconscious on your back. Not to mention making a landing that will be the standard of impossible in every flight manual for the next 1,000 years. Only because of your training, Master. That's just an excuse. You're the hero. Go spend your glorious days surrounded by...
Obi-Wan allowed himself a slightly disparaging cough.
Politicians.
Come on, Master. You owe me. And not just for saving your skin for the 10th time. 9th time. Cato Nymoidia doesn't count. It was your fault in the first place.
Obi-Wan waved him off.
See you at the Outer Rim briefing in the morning.
Well, all right. Just this once.
Anakin laughed and waved, and then headed briskly off to catch up with Palpatine as the Chancellor waded into the senators with the smooth-as-oiled transparisteel ease of the lifelong politician. The hatch cycled shut, the shuttle lifted off, and Obi-Wan's smile faded as he turned to Mace Windu.
You wanted to speak with me?
Windu moved close to Obi-Wan's position by the window, nodding out at the scene on the landing platform.
It's Anakin. I don't like his relationship with Palpatine.
We've had this conversation before.
There is something between them. Something new. I could see it in the Force.
Mace's voice was flat and grim.
It felt powerful and incredibly dangerous.
Obi-Wan spread his hands.
I trust Anakin with my life.
I know you do. I only wish we could trust the Chancellor with Anakin's.
Yes, Obi-Wan said, frowning. Palpatine's policies are sometimes questionable, but he dotes on Anakin like a kindly old uncle on his favorite nephew.
Mace stared out the window. The Chancellor loves power. If he has any other passion, I have not seen it. Obi-Wan shook his head with a trace of disbelief.
I recall that not so long ago, you were something of an admirer of his.
Things, Mace Windu said grimly, change.
Flying over a landscape pocked with smoldering wreckage, where once tall buildings filled with living beings had gleamed in the sun, toward a temple filled with memories of so many, many Jedi who would never return from this war, Obi-Wan could not disagree. After a moment, he said,
What would you have me do?
I am not certain. You know my power. I cannot always interpret what I've seen. Be alert. Be mindful of Anakin, and be careful of Palpatine. He is not to be trusted, and his influence on Anakin is dangerous.
But Anakin is the chosen one.
All the more reason to fear an outsider's influence. We have circumstantial evidence that traces Sidious to Palpatine's inner circle.
Suddenly, Obi-Wan had difficulty breathing.
Are you certain?
Mace shook his head. Nothing is certain. But this raid, the capture of Palpatine, had to be an inside job. And the timing. We were closing in on him, Master Kenobi. The information you and Anakin discovered, we had traced the Sith Lord to an abandoned factory in the works, not far from where Anakin landed the cruiser. When the attack began, we were tracking him through the down-level tunnels.
Mace stared out the viewport at a vast residential complex that dominated the skyline to the west.
The trail led to the sub-basement of 500 Republica.
500 Republica was the most exclusive address on the planet. Its inhabitants included only the incredibly wealthy or the incredibly powerful, from Wraith Sinar of the Sinar Systems conglomerate to Palpatine himself.
Obi-Wan could only say, Oh, we have to face the possibility, the probability, that what Dooku told you on Geonosis was actually true, that the Senate is under the influence, under the control of Darth Sidious, that it has been for years.
Do you?
Obi-Wan had to swallow before he could go on.
Do you have any suspects?
Too many. All we know of Sidious is that he's bipedal, of roughly human conformation. Say Pestich springs to mind. I wouldn't rule out Mas Amida either. The Sith Lord might even be hiding among the Red Guards. There's no way to know.
Who's handling the questioning?
Obi-Wan asked.
I'd be happy to sit in. My perceptions are not so refined as some, but...
Mace shook his head. Interrogate the Supreme Chancellor's personal aides and advisers? Impossible.
But I...
Palpatine will never allow it, though he hasn't said so.
Mace stared out the window.
I'm not sure he even believes the Sith exist.
Obi-Wan blinked.
But how can he...
Look at it from his point of view. The only real evidence we have is Dooku's word. And he's dead now.
The Sith Lord of Naboo. The Zabrak who killed Qui-Gon.
Mace shrugged. Destroyed. As you know. He shook his head. Relations with the Chancellor's office are difficult. I feel he has lost his trust in the Jedi. I have certainly lost my trust in him.
But he doesn't have the authority to interfere with a Jedi investigation.
Obi-Wan frowned, suddenly uncertain.
Does he?
The Senate has surrendered so much power, it's hard to say where his authority stops.
It's that bad?
Mace's jaw locked.
The only reason Palpatine's not a suspect is because he already rules the galaxy.
But we are closer than we have ever been to rooting out the Sith, Obi-Wan said slowly. That can only be good news. I would think that Anakin's friendship with Palpatine could be of use to us in this. He has the kind of access to Palpatine that other Jedi might only dream of. Their friendship is an asset, not a danger.
You can't tell him.
I beg your pardon?
Of the whole council, only Yoda and myself know how deep this actually goes. And now you. I have decided to share this with you, because you are in the best situation to watch Anakin. Watch him. Nothing more. We... Obi-Wan shook his head helplessly. We don't keep secrets from each other.
You must keep this one.
Mace laced his fingers together and squeezed until his knuckles crackled like blaster fire. Skywalker is arguably the most powerful Jedi alive, and he is still getting stronger. But he is not stable. You know it. We all do. It is why he cannot be given mastership. We must keep him off the council, despite his extraordinary gifts. And Jedi prophecy is not absolute. The less he has to do with Palpatine, the better.
But surely...
Obi-Wan stopped himself. He thought of how many times Anakin had violated orders. He thought of how unflinchingly loyal Anakin was to anyone he considered a friend. He thought of the danger Palpatine faced unknowingly with a Sith Lord among his advisors. Master Windu was right. This was a secret Anakin could not be trusted to keep. What can I tell him?
Tell him nothing. I sense the dark side around him. Around them both.
As it is around us all, Obi-Wan reminded him. The dark side touches all of us, Master Windu. Even you.
I know that too well, Obi-Wan.
For one second, Obi-Wan saw something raw and haunted in the Koran Master's eyes. Mace turned away.
It is possible that we may have to move against Palpatine.
Move against?
If he is truly under the control of a Sith Lord, it may be the only way.
Obi-Wan's whole body had gone numb. This didn't seem real. It was not possible that he was actually having this conversation.
You haven't been here, Obi-Wan.
Mace stared bleakly down at his hands.
You've been off fighting the war in the Outer Rim. You don't know what it's been like, dealing with all the petty squabbles and special interests and greedy, grasping fools in the Senate, and Palpatine's constant, cynical, ruthless maneuvering for power. He carves away chunks of our freedom and bandages the wounds with tiny scraps of security. And for what? Look at this planet, Obi-Wan. We have given up so much freedom. How secure do we look?
Obi-Wan's heart clenched. This was not the Mace Windu he knew and admired. It was as though the darkness in the Force was so much thicker here on Coruscant that it had breathed poison into Mace's spirit, and perhaps was even breeding suspicion and dissension among the members of the Jedi Council. The greatest danger from the darkness outside came when Jedi fed it with the darkness within. He had feared he might find matters had deteriorated when he returned to Coruscant and the temple. Not even in his darkest dreams had he thought it would get this bad.
Master Windu, Mace, we'll go to Yoda together, he said firmly.
And among the three of us, we'll work something out.
We will. You'll see.
It may be too late already.
It may be, and it may not be. We can only do what we can do, Mace. A very, very wise Jedi once said to me, "We don't have to win. All we have to do is fight." Some of the lines erased themselves from the Koran Master's face then, and when he met Obi-Wan's eye, there was a quirk at the corner of his mouth that might someday develop into a smile. A tired, sad smile, but a smile nonetheless.
I seem, he said slowly, to have forgotten that particular Jedi. Thank you for reminding me.
It was the least I could do, Obi-Wan said lightly, but a sad weight had gathered on his chest.
Things change, indeed.
Anakin's heart pounded in his throat, but he kept smiling and nodding and shaking hands and trying desperately to work his way toward a familiar golden-domed protocol droid who hung back beyond the crowd of senators, right arm lifted in a small tentative wave at R2-D2.
She wasn't here. Why wasn't she here?
Something must have happened.
He knew, deep in his guts, that something had happened to her. An accident, or she was sick, or she'd been caught in one of the vast number of buildings hit by debris from the battle today. She might be trapped somewhere right now, might be wounded, might be smothering, calling out his name, might be feeling the approach of flames.
Stop it, he told himself. She's not hurt. If anything had happened to her, he would know. Even from the far side of the Outer Rim, he would know. So why wasn't she here? Had something... He could barely breathe. He couldn't make himself even think it. He couldn't stop himself from thinking it. Had something changed? For her? In how she felt? He managed to disengage himself from Tundra Domain's clammy grip and insistent invitations to visit his family's deepwater estate on Mon Calamari. He slid past the Molesterian Senator Ask-Ack with an apologetic shrug. He had a different senator on his mind. R2 was weeping and beeping and whistling intensely when Anakin finally struggled free of the mass of sweaty, grasping politicians. C-3PO had turned away dismissively.
It couldn't have been that bad. Don't exaggerate. You're hardly even dented.
R2's answering furoo sounded a little defensive. C-3PO sent a wisp of static through his vocabulator that sounded distinctly like a disapproving sniff.
On that point, I agree. You're long overdue for a tune-up. And, if I may say so, a bath.
3PO. Anakin came up close beside the droid he had built in the back room of his mother's slave hovel on Tatooine. The droid who had been both project and friend through his painful childhood. The droid who now served the woman he loved. 3PO had been with her all these months, had seen her every day, had touched her, perhaps even today. He could feel echoes of her resonating outward from his electroplated shell, and they left him breathless.
Oh, Master Anakin!
3PO exclaimed.
I am very glad to find you well. One does worry when friends fall out of touch. Why, I was saying to the Senator just the other day, or was it last week? Time seems to run together, so... Do you think you might have the opportunity to adjust my internal calendar settings while you're...
3PO, have you seen her? Anakin was trying so hard not to shout that his voice came out a strangled croak. Where is she? Why isn't she here?
Oh, well, certainly, certainly. Officially, Senator Amidala is extremely busy.
C-3PO said imperturbably.
She has been sequestered all day in the Naboo Embassy, reviewing the new Security Act, preparing for tomorrow's debate.
Anakin couldn't breathe. She wasn't here, hadn't come to meet him, over some debate? The Senate. He hated the Senate. Hated everything about it. A red haze gathered inside his head. Those self-righteous, narrow-minded, grubby little squabblers. He'd be doing the galaxy a favor if he were to go over there right now and just... Wait, he murmured, blinking. Did you say... officially?
Oh, yes, Master Anakin.
3PO sounded entirely virtuous.
That is my official answer to all queries regarding the Senator's whereabouts, all afternoon.
The red haze evaporated, leaving only sunlight and dizzyingly fresh air. Anakin smiled. And unofficially? The protocol droid leaned close with an exaggeratedly conspiratorial whisper.
Unofficially? She's waiting in the hallway.
It felt like being struck by lightning. But in a good way. In the best way any man has ever felt since, roughly, the birth of the universe. 3PO gave a slight nod at the other senators and the holonet crews on the gangway.
She thought it best to avoid a, public scene. And she wished for me to relate to you that she believes that both of you might avoid a public scene all afternoon, and perhaps all night as well.
3PO! Anakin blinked at him. He felt an irrational desire to giggle. What exactly are you suggesting?
I'm sure I couldn't say, sir. I am only performing as per the Senator's instructions.
You... Anakin shook his head in wonder while his smile grew to a grin he thought might split open his cheeks. You are amazing!
Thank you, Master Anakin. Though credit for that is due largely.
C-3PO made an elegantly gracious bow.
To my creator.
Anakin could only go on grinning. With that, the golden protocol droid laid an affectionate hand on R2's dome.
Come along, R2. I have found the most delightful body shop down in the Lipartian Way.
They moved away, whirring and clanking after the senators who were already off among the holonet crews. Anakin's smile faded as he watched them go. He felt a presence at his shoulder and turned to find Palpatine beside him, with a warm smile and a soft word, as he always seemed to be when Anakin was troubled. "What is it, Anakin?" the Chancellor asked kindly. "Something is disturbing you. I can tell." Anakin shrugged and gave his head a dismissive shake, embarrassed. "It's nothing." "Anakin, anything that might upset a man such as yourself is certainly something. Let me help." "There's nothing you can do. It's just..." Anakin nodded after 3PO and R2. "I was just thinking that, even after all I've done, C-3PO is still the only person I know who calls me Master." "Ah, the Jedi Council." Palpatine slid an arm around Anakin's shoulders and gave him a comradely squeeze. "I believe I can be of some use to you in this problem after all." "You can." "I should be very much surprised if I couldn't." Palpatine's smile was still warm, but his eyes had gone distant. "You may have noticed that I have a certain gift," he murmured, "for getting my way." Chapter 9. Padme. From the shadow of a great pillar, stretching up into the reddening afternoon that leaked through the vaulted roof of transparasteel over the atrium of the Senate office building, she watched senators clustering in through the archway from the Chancellor's landing platform. And then she saw the Chancellor himself, and C-3PO. And yes, that was R2-D2, and so he could not be far behind. And only then did she finally find him among them, tall and straight, his hair radiation bleached to golden streaks, and on his lips a lively smile that opened her chest and unlocked her heart. And she could breathe again. Through the swirl of HoloNet reporters and the chatter of senators and the gently comforting tones of Palpatine's most polished, reassuringly paternal voice, she did not move, not so much as to lift a hand or turn her head. She was silent and still, only letting herself breathe, feeling the beat of her heart. And she could have stood there forever, in the shadows, and had her fondest dreams all fulfilled simply by watching him be alive. But when he moved away from the group, pacing in soft conversation with Bail Organa of Alderaan, and she heard Bail saying something about the end of Count Dooku and the end of the war, and finally an end to Palpatine's police state tactics, her breath caught again, and she held it, because she knew the next thing she heard would be his voice. "I wish that were so," he said, "but the fighting will continue until General Grievous's spare parts. The Chancellor is very clear on this, and I believe the Senate and the Jedi Council will both agree." And beyond that, there was no hope she could be happier, until his eye found her silent, still shadow, and he straightened. And a new light broke over his golden face, and he said, "Excuse me," to the senator from Alderaan. And a moment later, he came to her in the shadows, and they were in each other's arms. Their lips met, and the universe became, one last time, perfect. This is Padme Amidala. She is an astonishingly accomplished young woman, who in her short life has been already the youngest ever elected queen of her planet, a daring partisan guerrilla, and a measured, articulate, and persuasive voice of reason in the Republic Senate. But she is, at this moment, none of these things. She can still play at them. She pretends to be a senator. She still wields the moral authority of a former queen. And she is not shy about using her reputation for fierce physical courage to her advantage in political debate. But her inmost reality, the most fundamental, unbreakable core of her being, is something entirely different. She is Anakin Skywalker's wife. Yet wife is a word too weak to carry the truth of her. Wife is such a small word, such a common word. A word that can come from a downturned mouth with so many petty, unpleasant echoes. For Padme Amidala, saying, "I am Anakin Skywalker's wife," is saying neither more nor less than "I am alive." Her life before Anakin belonged to someone else, some lesser being to be pitied. Some poor, impoverished spirit who could never suspect how profoundly life should be lived. Her real life began the first time she looked into Anakin Skywalker's eyes and found him there, not the uncritical worship of little Annie from Tatooine, but the direct, unashamed, smoldering passion of a powerful